Maybe I should have gone first, Kojo. That's a bit of a difficult act to follow. Like everyone else, I'd really like to thank the organizers. And I think because this is a conference and an exhibition that's on labor, I think that that point bears reiterating to thank this crack team. I also really want to thank the panel that came before, because without knowing they're providing a certain amount of terminology that I'm going to appropriate. I think I'm just going to start. So as a point of entry, I want to start with the video Weaving that was made in Hanoi. That was the first video that we saw. So what do we see? There's a loom in motion. The screen is divided horizontally. The machine, a complex architecture of joists and metal that is Benjamin's dream materials of the 19th century, is in motion. It's a beautiful, rusty, old machine, and it moves in a most elegant and pleasing way. It makes a sound. It looks like it's from another time, maybe even Benjamin's time. Behind it, slowly revealed, is the weaver, a woman who collects from this loom a tapey lace that she ravels into a ball. She is dressed in pink and white from head to toe. It's a great outfit. But her dexterity and her role as captain of this loom is somehow not what the eye is directed to. What we are guided to look at instead are the exquisite joists and curves of the loom that dances almost of its own volition, and in fact continues to do so after she bows off stage. So what we see is a reversal, where the machine somehow is the agent, endowed with life, dancing around, doing its thing. The woman, in spite of her skill and cinematic quality, literally is behind the machine. It's a Granvillian image, if there ever was one, where the commodities come to life and take center stage. Or from another point of view, she is behind the machine, as Franco Berardi states in After the Future, his history of the end of the future. And he says, "Futurism exalted the machine as an external object, visible in the city landscape, but now the machine is inside us. We are no longer obsessed with the external machine. Instead, the info machine now intersects with the social nervous system. The biomachine interacts with the genetic becoming of the human organism. In the mechanical era, the machine stood in front of the body and changed human behavior, enhancing their potency without changing their physical structure. The assembly line, for instance, although improving and increasing the productive power of laborers, did not modify their physical organism nor introduce mutations inside their cognitive ability. Now the machine is no more in front of the body, but inside it. Bodies and minds, therefore, cannot express and relate anymore without the technical support of the biomachine." Oh, my hands are shaking. You know, I was wondering, you know, I've been here for 3 days now. I was wondering what it would be like to be on this platform here. And it's actually a lot more relaxed than I thought it would be. Just as a note. So Bifo points out that Marinetti's Futurist Manifesto was published in 1909, the same year that Henry Ford initiated the first assembly line in Detroit. This is no coincidence, nor, he states, is it a coincidence that the most fiery proponents of futurism were in the agrarian economies of Italy and Russia. The machine stood in front of the laborer, paving the way to an industrial future. As we all might already know, Bifo says that we are in a different time now. The machine is not in front of us. It is inside of us and makes us anxious and depressed. Our souls are on the factory floor. The machine is not outside of us, it is in us. We are sped up from the inside out at the pace of an accelerated capitalism. Okay, but what if we stop for a second and question the polarity of this distinction, the machine in front of us, as opposed to the machine inside of us? What if instead we blurred this distinction between the machine being inside or in front of the laborer, or we found a threshold where the ambivalence of both modes of the bodily and the machinic coincided? Through these videos that we saw at the beginning of this session, I want to consider two possible thresholds where the machine and the body meet in uneasy contretemps. In the gesture, whose endpoint is the skin, and in the voice, whose endpoint is singing. Through these two thresholds, the gesture and the voice, I want to look at these videos anew. Not in any sort of celebratory way, but as is. To think about the role of embodiment and the machine that straddle what Thomas Elsasser so eloquently evoked in his keynote. And that is the knife-edged constitution of labor as hovering between a recognition of its dignity and its inevitable dehumanization. So what I'm thinking about in relation with the liminality of the gesture, in the very specific context of its relation to the machine and the labor process, where the gesture is only intelligible in its mediating role with the machine. So in Cola Bottles, that was shot in Cairo, we see two laborers on screen tossing packages of Coke bottles in a chain from one to the other and then to another person who's off screen. At first glance, the sequence of gestures could be considered to be almost machinic in its synchronicity. And yet, what destabilizes this most dramatically is the stumble, is the glitch, when the man closest to the camera moves too quickly and in his fumbling recovery throws a crate to the side. He also pauses and he makes strange nods. The fumble does not throw him off, however, but maybe it throws us off as a viewer. This glitch also calls attention to the machine-like nature of the tossing, but also the subjectivity of those making the gestures. The breaks in rhythm makes us aware of the rhythm itself. Or in Ultraviolet, that was shot in Buenos Aires, we hear what Kojo has characterized as the industrialization of the voice, of the horse racing announcer, its sped-up quality just inside the threshold of intelligibility. He sounds excited. But consider his voice in contrast with how he carries his body. His voice is fast, but his body is slow. He moves, he picks up his binoculars, almost absent-mindedly, and points them to the screen, rather to the scene outside. He's operating at two temporal registers, where his slow, relaxed gestures give us a glimpse of how habituated he is, how his attention can be there and elsewhere. An attention to gesture might also take us to that of the camera person who is necessarily off-screen. When the camera is controlled and does not call attention to the gesture of the camera person, as it is in Ultraviolet, the camera person hovers as being both present and absent. When the camera is handheld, as it is in Cola Bottles or in Mate and Leather, its contingency parachutes us into the time and space of action. So I want to consider how, at its limit, the gesture and the relationship to the machine takes us to the skin through an example that takes us a little bit away from the films for a few minutes. And that is to sort of talk about a history of fingerprints and the gestures and machines that produce them, and finally, their destruction. Hopefully this makes sense. So in 1858, William Herschel, the chief magistrate of the Hooghly district in Jungipur, was finalizing a contract with Rajadhar Konai to produce some guting, that is a binding material to build light roads. When Konai was about to sign the contract, Herschel was inspired to ask Konai to make a stamp of his hand on the contract. Herschel had no thought of the actual imprint or what the imprint would tell about him. Rather, it was the gesture of implicating Konai's hand and by extension his body into the contract by pulling his hand to the sheet of paper. Said Herschel, quote, "I was only wishing to frighten Konai out of all thought of repudiating his signature hereafter," unquote. So in a way, he wanted to frighten Konai into honoring the contract by marking him and using the mark as a contract. Okay, I'm going to time travel a little bit into the future. So consider an afterlife of this gesture, and that is the collecting of biometric information at a national or international scale. In India, this is a quote-unquote voluntary system that's launched at a massive scale to create a national ID. For a population with a very high literacy rate and low income levels, so that alternate forms of ID, that is passports or driver's license, are not as common. So a description of this photograph that you see in front of you by Getty Images says, an Indian villager is helped by an official to put her hand on the slap pad for the recording of fingerprints during the data collection process for a pilot project of the Unique Identification Authority of India in the village of Chellur, some 145 kilometers northwest of Bangalore on April 22, 2010. This identification authority has been created as an attached office under the Planning Commission. Its role is to develop and implement the necessary institutional, technical, and legal infrastructure to issue these identity numbers to Indian residents. And then it goes on and sort of talks about how great this is. But I don't think it is that great. I think there's a kind of this repetition of, you can imagine thousands and thousands of hands on the stamp, on the scanner, collecting these fingerprints. Well, what happens with these fingerprints? Well, I want to consider another collection of fingerprints, and that is by the Eurodac, which is the European database that collects fingerprints of illegalized migrants entering the European Union. The records of these fingerprints are used to send migrants back to their first country of entry in order to be deported. One of the biggest deterrents for illegalized migrants in the European Union is the requirement that they seek asylum in the first European Union country they have entered and have been fingerprinted in. And the threat of being deported back there is so unacceptable to many migrants that it became a common practice for them to try to erase their own fingerprints by drinking chemicals and by burning the skin off their fingertips. So consider from this point of view the response and resistance to this database on the part of the migrant who destroys their fingerprints in order to evade this detection. This is a still from Sylvain Georges' documentary film, Qu'il se repose en révolte, that records this act. It's an image of the hands of a migrant who has attempted to burn his fingerprints off so he can avoid identification. His hands then carry the imprint of the law and of his own journey. This act is painful, and the trace it leaves is difficult to look at. And this is a Sisyphean task, as fingerprints always grow back. But what is relevant in this instance to the distinction that I have traced at the beginning of this between the machine in front of the body and the machine inside the body is the way in which this gesture is only intelligible as a response to the Eurodac, as a response to the machinic collection of this biometric data. The gesture of erasing the fingerprints and the trace it leaves is only painful and debilitating in the life of the migrant outside of this apparatus. The second site of liminality that I want to look at is that of the voice. We've already considered the fast voice of the horse racing commentator and his slow gestures. But there are other voices too. There's the terrible, absolutely horrendous pop music that you hear happening in Mate and Leather. There's the azan, or the call to prayer, in the Coke bottles. There's the singing of the loom in the weaving. These are all sounds that all the workers hear together. These voices, like the industrialized voice of the horse racing commentator, operate on the threshold of intelligibility. But here, not account of their speed, but on account of the dispersion across the space. So there's a collective listening, perhaps distractedly so. With the azan, the call to prayer in Cairo, it signals dusk, it signals the end of the working day. It is a collective experience shared to pace the day. It is also part of the massive sound pollution that permeates the city of Cairo. You'll never hear the azan in isolation of other sounds in the city. And then, yes, the yucky top 40 music that paces the working day of the workers in Mate and Leather. It paces the day, and it paces their gestures, it paces their cutting of leather, it paces the passing of the vial of mate, the performance of another collective ritual. These are the shared sounds that form the collective experience of working, that pace the day and pace the gestures of work, that I want to push further and radically to one of the first moments of the dehumanization of labor under modernity, that is, the transportation of slaves across the Atlantic and the putting of these enslaved people to work on plantations. There's another set of sonics that comes out of this shared experience of dehumanization of labor that has its birth in the hold of the slave ship that Fred Moten, in his book on the Undercommons that he wrote with Stefano Harney, describes as haptic. And he says, "Never being on the right side of the Atlantic is an unsettled feeling, the feeling of a thing that unsettles with others. To have been shipped is to have been moved by others, with others. In the hold, another kind of feeling became common. This form of feeling was not collective, not given to decision, not adhering or reattaching to settlement, nation, state, territory, or historical story. Nor was it repossessed by the group, which could not now feel as one, reunified in time and space." No, when Black Shadow sings, "Are you feeling the feeling?" he's asking about something else. He's asking about a way of feeling through others, a feeling for feeling others, feeling you. This is modernity's insurgent feel, its inherited caress, its skin talk, touch, tongue touch, breath speed, hand laugh. This is the feel we might call hapticality. Hapticality, the touch of the undercommons, the interiority of sentiment, the feel that what is to come is here. Hapticality, the capacity to feel through others, for others to feel through you, for you, to feel them feeling you. This feel of the ship is not regulated, at least not successfully, by a state, a religion, a people, an empire, a piece of land, a totem. Or perhaps we could say these are now recomposed in the wake of the ship. Refuse these things, we first refuse them in the contained, amongst the contained, lying together in the ship, the boxcar, the prison, the hostel. Skin against epidermalization, senses touching. Though forced to touch and be touched, to sense and be sensed in that space for no other space, though refuse sentiment, history, and home, we feel for each other. Soul music is a medium of this interiority on the skin. Fred Moten's such a great writer. I had to put that in its entirety. So feeling the feeling is a point of entry to understand the incomprehensible, how music and voice become vehicles of this haptic experience of being on board a slave ship. This is before a sense of collectivity can be formed, before a language articulated can be formed contra the state. It's a state of a something else that arises viscerally beyond language's intelligibility. Its radicality plays out sonically, but also, as he states, at the level of skin, in the pharmaconic surface that is created in the unnameable experience in the hold, but also in the sense of touch that becomes the beginning of what Moten calls an insurgency. This experience is synesthetic. It pulls together the sense of touch together with the sense of song. So skin and voice are the sites of contestation and agency. They are literally at the border between techne and the body, and its hapticality comes into being in the machine of the hold. Its afterlife, Moten states, comes into the continued experience of slavery on plantations and in prisons. Its song continues in the form of work songs, songs on the chain gang. These are the soundtracks to work. It paces the gestures of indentured work in the afterlife of the hold. According to Bruce Jackson in his book Wake Up Dead Man, the large plantations in the US South were based on West African agricultural models, and with one major difference, that the black slaves used work songs in the plantations exactly as they'd used them before they'd been taken prisoner and sold into slavery. The difference was this: in Africa, the songs were used to time body movements and to give poetic voice to things of interest because people wanted to do their work that way. But in the plantations, there is the added component of survival. If a man was singled out as working too slowly, he would often be brutally punished. The songs kept everyone together, so no one could be singled out as working more slowly than everyone else. Work songs helped African-American prisoners survive the grueling work demanded of them. So I want to turn now to an actual recording of a song on the Chain Gang in a documentary that was made by Pete Seeger. So he's sort of the protagonist, and he's sort of the hero of this film, problematically or not, and I will come back to that later. But I'll tell you a little bit about this film, and then we will watch a clip of it. So Pete Seeger and Toshi Seeger and their son Daniel and the folklorist Bruce Jackson, who I just mentioned, they went to a Texas prison in Huntsville in March of 1966. And they produced this document that you're going to see in a second of inmates of the Ellis unit. So this is a part of a larger process of folklorists, mostly from the north, becoming very fascinated by what they saw as a dying form, a dying musical form. So all the kind of anthropological colonialism that you can associate with this became the sort of impetus to record these songs and the gestures that went with them. So we have this archive ambivalently, as it were. So if you can play the clip now.
I remember when I first came in prison, man, boss wouldn't let me cut no wood. He asked me, you ever cut no wood? I said, I've never cut no wood in my life. He said, you put that axe down. I said, it cuts wood here. I said, you stand right there and I'll show you how they cut wood. And he hollered over old Chime and said, old Chime, what's the thing, son? He'd be singing the lead on the Let the Hammer Ring, a variety of verses. Everybody be in chords with him, Let the Hammer Ring, and all axes be dropping. And when the timber's on the ground, there'd be 300 axes dropping with him, all in harmony. That's something to hear. I had never seen nothing like that in my life.
He can't hold them, Let the Hammer Ring. Why don't you drop them?
Unlike many prisons in the North, where men often spend most of their days sitting around in cells, the inmates work in Texas prisons. In the old days, work in the field sometimes amounted to a death sentence by degree. The guards were brutal, the days lasted from dawn to dark, the work pace was vicious. But Texas now has the most progressive of the southern prison systems, and those old days have gone. Even so, some of the Negro inmates maintain a tradition that developed then to help a man survive, the prison work song.
I got it need all over again.
down the line. Oh, my daddy was a bully, I could walk on the line. It takes a number one to walk on the line. I got a timberline, and you can walk on the line. I got a timberline, and you can walk on the line. Big timber in the bottom, you can walk on the line. It takes a number one driver on the line. Oh, won't you come along, daddy, we can come along. Oh, won't you come along, daddy, we can come along. Come along with your partner, we can come along. It takes a number one driver on the line. We can come on the line. Let fool you can't hold me. We can come on the line. Well, let fool you can't hold me. We can come on the line. It takes a number one to come on the line. Better watch my helmet. We can come on the line.
Circle rhythm ritual, right, in its most dehumanized form. So it's pretty awful to hear Pete Seeger talk about how great these new prisons were. But the presence of the prison guard mounted on his horse, looking down on them, undermines that voiceover. And under the watchful eye of the guard and the camera, and Seeger's, I'd say, somewhat condescending voiceover, something else happens in the afterlife of the hold. Another kind of syncopation of movement that gets the overseer's job done, but also collects from below, in the rhythm and in the singing, a powerful voice, a powerful force that moves this indentured labor in another direction. When he wrote about this recording, Bruce Jackson, who went along with Pete Seeger, said, quote, "A day or two after we finished the filming and Pete, Tashi, and Dan had gone back to New York, a convict I'd been seeing for several years, but who had never talked to me, stopped me in the Ellis Corridor and said, 'How come you never recorded me singing any of them river songs?' River songs is what they called them because nearly all the Texas prisons in those days were in the rich bottomland along the Brazos and the Trinity Rivers. They were the 19th century plantations hiding in the 20th century. 'Oh, I never knew you had any,' I said. 'Well, I never knew you knew Pete Seeger,' he said." When he said that line to me, I was really tickled by it because I was certain that until Pete had got there, up in the gymnasium a few nights earlier, he had never heard of Pete Seeger and his long-necked five-string banjo and a 12-string guitar, and neither had most of the men incarcerated or working in that penitentiary. I told the story a lot of times over the years and always thought that when I told it, how amusing it was that guy said that thing about Pete, about whom he knew nothing before the concert in the gymnasium. But now I've come to realize that there's something far more important and substantial in what that man said to me in the Ellis Corridor. There was something we shared, so he and I weren't just total strangers to one another after all. Singing songs about things that really matter and thinking about these things, which leave them, which leave us, however many hours later, with some kind of feeling, some kind of knowledge that transcends the moment entirely, a feeling and knowledge about the things that bond rather than the things that rend, about what it means to be human rather than what it means to be brutal, about how we must and can get on together by conspiring in the best and most basic sense of the word that is breathing together. And then he goes on and sort of talks about how Pete Seeger was a genius and he made this all happen. So it was not, the protagonist is not the work song, the protagonist is Pete Seeger. But I think in here there's some kind of resonance between what Fred Moten was talking about. So I want to stop here at the intersection of gesture and voice that is behind the machine, that contains the machine, that is co-opted by those, like those making documentaries like this, who try to speak for those who are dehumanized by labor, and that those who make also slightly dangerous and wishy-washy statements about how progressive one state prison can be over another. But in spite of this kind of co-optation and speaking for, there's also a stubborn remainder, a haptic feeling the feeling that plays out in uneasy juxtaposition and in syncopation. Thank you.